picture this. You're walking down the street, and suddenly you see this violent attack happening right in front of you. It's chaotic. People are scared.
Yeah.
But what if the attacker actually thought they were the one in danger? Like they were defending themselves against something only they could see.
A threat that wasn't even real.
Exactly. A threat that didn't even exist.
That's the question at the heart of this California Supreme Court case we're diving into today. People v. Elmore.
It really makes you think about self-defense mental illness and where the line is between murder and manslaughter. And that's what we're going to unpack today. Why it matters for you.
This case is a prime example of how tough it is to make sense of mental illness in the eyes of the law.
Yeah.
And the person at the center of it all is Charles Elmore. He had a history of schizophrenia and psychosis. We're talking documented history here.
Right.
He was in and out of institutions. And in the time leading up to what happened, people had seen him acting really erratically, even saying things that sounded like straight up delusions.
So this wasn't just a one-time thing. It sounds like there was a pattern of behavior here.
Exactly. And that context is really important for understanding how things played out.
Okay, so set the scene for us. What happened that led to this case going all the way to the Supreme Court?
Well, Elmore ran into this woman, Ella Suggs, at a bus stop.
Well,
and just out of nowhere, it seemed he attacked her with this sharpened paintbrush handle.
Oh, wow.
Tragically, Miss Suggs died from her injuries, and witnesses said Elmore seemed confused and disoriented right after the attack. Which, you know, raises some big questions about his mental state and what he was even trying to do.
That's a really disturbing situation. And it sounds like there's a lot more to the story than meets the eye.
Hmm.
So how did this case even get to the Supreme Court?
Well, it went through a whole journey through the legal system.
I bet.
Elmore was charged with first degree murder, but his lawyers decided to go with a two-prong defense. They pleaded not guilty and not guilty by reason of insanity.
So they were trying to cover all their bases.
Yeah, that's what's called a bifurcated trial, meaning they deal with the question of guilt first, and then separately, they look at whether he was sane at the time.
Okay, so two separate arguments with the potential for different outcomes depending on which one stuck.
Exactly. In that first part, the guilt phase, they tried to use his mental illness to lessen the charges, you know, arguing maybe it was unreasonable self-defense or a mistake of fact, like his delusions were driving his actions, not some evil intent.
I see.
But the trial court didn't buy it.
It seems like if Elmore clearly had mental health issues, you'd think that would automatically help his case.
Right.
Why didn't it?
Well, this is where things take a turn. After he was found guilty of murder, Elmore actually went against his own lawyer's advice and withdrew his insanity plea.
Wait, hold on. Why would he do that? That seems like a crucial part of his defense, especially knowing what we know about his mental state.
It seems like a misstep in their legal strategy. By withdrawing the plea, he basically shut the door on using his mental state as a defense in the sanity phase of the trial. It was a decision that would have a ripple effect on everything that came next.
So now the big question is, can a delusion, a threat that isn't even real, ever be considered self-defense under the law? I'm guessing this is the main issue the Supreme Court had to wrestle with.
You hit the nail on the head. To get why the Supreme Court decided what they did, we have to dive into some legal technicalities, specifically the difference between a mistake of fact and a delusion.
Okay, all ears, break it down for us.
So a mistake of fact is when you misinterpret something that's actually there. Like, let's say you see a coiled up hose in your yard at night and think it's a snake.
I've done that.
You're reacting to something real, but you've got it wrong.
Right.
A delusion, though, is when you perceive a threat that has absolutely no basis in reality whatsoever.
So even if someone truly believes they're in danger because of a delusion, the law doesn't see that as legitimate self-defense.
That's the thing. And that's where the Supreme Court's majority opinion comes in. They made it clear that California law, at least as it stands right now, doesn't allow you to use delusions as a reason for a lesser charge during the guilt phase of a trial. Remember, in this phase, they assume you're sane until proven otherwise.
So for those of us who aren't lawyers, is the court saying that mental illness can't be used as a defense at all?
Not quite. What they're saying is that while mental illness can be a defense, it has to be argued within a specific legal framework.
Right.
And in Elmore's case, that framework was the sanity phase of the trial, which he unfortunately skipped over.
And just to add another layer of complexity here, wasn't there also a specific rule in California about using sharp objects in an attack?
That's right. You're remembering correctly. The court brought up the fact that in California, if you stab someone with something sharp, it automatically suggests malice. It doesn't matter what your mental state was. The very act itself shows a conscious disregard for human life. And that meets the legal definition of implied malice, which makes it murder.
Wow. I can see how this puts defendants with a history of mental illness in a really tough spot. Their reality might be totally different, but the law doesn't always account for that.
You've hit a crucial point, and that's exactly why the dissenting opinion in this case is so important. Justice Kennard actually disagreed with the majority's reasoning, even though she ended up agreeing with the outcome in this specific case.
So even within the Supreme Court, there was disagreement about how to apply the law here. Tell me more about Justice Kennard's dissent. What was her perspective?
Her argument was that delusional beliefs should actually be considered when deciding if a murder charge should be reduced to manslaughter. And this is even during the guilt phase.
Oh, interesting.
She pointed to a specific part of the law, Penal Code Section 28A, which says you can use evidence of mental illness to show the defendant didn't have the malice needed for a murder charge, whether their belief is based in reality or not.
So even if they're basing their actions on a delusion?
Right. It's like if you truly believed someone was attacking you and you fought back in what you thought was self-defense, even if the threat wasn't real.
Yeah.
Her point was that the law should take that mental state into account.
That seems reasonable.
Yeah.
It sounds like she was saying the law as it's written already allows for some wiggle room when considering delusions in these kinds of cases.
You got it. Her dissent really highlights just how complex this whole thing is and how you can interpret the law in different ways and end up with different conclusions. But of course, the majority opinion is what sets the precedent here.
Right. So even though Elmore withdrew his insanity plea, let's talk about what could have happened if he hadn't. I mean, the insanity defense was still an option, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Even though California's laws about mental illness mean you can't argue for a lesser charge based on delusions during the guilt phase, the insanity defense can still come into play during the sanity phase,
right,
which happens after the guilty verdict.
Right. For those of us who haven't been in law school lately, remind us what that standard is. How does that work in a case like this?
The Emnighton standard basically comes down to this question. At the time of the crime, did the defendant understand what they were doing was wrong?
Okay.
Could they tell right from wrong? If the answer is no, they might be found not guilty by reason of insanity.
So you're saying that if Elmore hadn't withdrawn his plea, there was a chance he could have been found not guilty, even after being found guilty of the actual act.
It's impossible to say for sure, of course. But given his history of serious mental illness, the way the attack happened, his behavior afterwards, it seems like there was a strong case to be made that he didn't understand what he did was wrong.
Sounds like a missed opportunity for the defense. It really shows how crucial it is for lawyers to know criminal law and mental health law inside and out.
Okay.
One wrong move can change the entire course of a case.
No doubt. This case is a big wake-up call for defense attorneys to really think strategically about how they approach cases that involve mental illness, especially when it comes to timing and choosing the right defense.
Okay, so stepping outside the courtroom, what are some of the bigger implications of this ruling? How does a case like People v. Elmore change the way we think about mental illness and criminal responsibility?
This case sets a precedent in California. It makes it clear that while mental illness can be a factor in criminal cases, it's not a get-out-of-jail-free card. The defense has to work within the existing legal framework, which can be tough when you're dealing with something as unpredictable as mental illness.
This sounds like a really delicate balancing act.
It definitely is. And this case really sparks a debate about where law and mental health intersect. We have to think about accountability and justice for the victims, but we also have to consider the huge impact mental illness can have on someone's thoughts and actions. It raises this question: if someone genuinely doesn't understand that what they're doing is wrong, how do we hold them responsible?
So where does that leave us then? What are some key things for listeners to remember, especially those in the legal world?
If there's one thing lawyers should take away from People v. Elmore, it's the importance of timing and strategy in these kinds of cases.
Right. The decision highlights the need for defense attorneys to carefully consider when and how they bring up mental illness as part of their strategy. Choosing the right defense from the get-go can make all the difference.
So it's not just about presenting evidence of mental illness and hoping for the best?
Not at all. The Elmore case makes it clear that you can't use delusional beliefs to argue for a lesser charge during the guilt phase of a trial. If you want to use mental illness to negate malice and try to get a murder charge reduced to manslaughter, you have to go with an insanity defense.
And that means focusing on the Emnighton standard during the sanity phase.
Exactly. This case really underscores how important it is to understand all the ins and outs of different legal defenses and pick the right one for each situation.
It sounds like defense attorneys need to be experts in both criminal law and mental health law to really be effective in these cases.
Couldn't agree more. It's not just about knowing the law. It's also about understanding the complexities of mental illness, how it shows up, and how to present that evidence in court in a way that's both convincing and legally sound. So what's the bottom line here? What's the main message you hope people take away from this whole case?
For me, the biggest takeaway is that we need a more nuanced and compassionate way of looking at mental illness in the criminal justice system. The Elmore case shows how limited our current system is. It challenges us to find better ways to balance accountability with understanding and support for people dealing with mental health challenges. It's a reminder that the law doesn't always perfectly reflect the realities of human experience, especially when it comes to mental illness.
It's a conversation that goes way beyond the courtroom, don't you think?
Without a doubt, it's a societal issue that needs our attention. How do we make sure victims get justice while also recognizing how complicated mental illness is and how it affects people's actions? There are no easy answers, but the Elmore case forces us to face these tough questions head on.
This deep dive has been quite the journey. Legal twists and turns, ethical questions, and thought-provoking insights. Feels like we've only scratched the surface.
We've definitely covered a lot of ground today, but the conversation shouldn't end here. People v. Elmore is a landmark case that has far-reaching implications. It's a case that's going to be discussed and analyzed for years to come, and hopefully it'll lead to some real changes in how we as a society approach mental illness, both within the legal system and beyond.
Speaking of the complexities of this case, we should probably touch on Justice Kinnard's dissenting opinion again. It seemed to highlight some potential issues with the majority's reasoning, didn't it?
You're absolutely right. Justice Kinnard's dissent was powerful and really made you think. Her main argument was that even though delusions aren't rooted in reality, they should still be able to reduce a murder charge to manslaughter.
So she was basically saying that the law already allows for mental illness to potentially change a murder conviction to manslaughter. Like, the majority was misinterpreting the law.
Basically, yeah. She specifically referred to Penal Code Section 28A to support her argument. That section says you can use evidence of mental illness to show that a defendant didn't have the necessary malice for murder, even if their belief in self-defense was based on a delusion.
That's a really interesting point. It sounds like there's room for debate about how that part of the law should be interpreted.
It's definitely a gray area, and that's part of what makes legal precedent so interesting and sometimes frustrating. Justice Kinnard argued that the majority opinion in People v. Elmore went too far in excluding delusional self-defense from being considered during the guilt phase. She felt like it unfairly limited defendants with mental illness from presenting a complete defense.
So even though she ultimately agreed with the outcome of this particular case, she didn't agree with the logic behind it.
Exactly. She felt that Elmore's mental state should have been given more weight during the guilt phase, and that this strict separation between the guilt and sanity phases can sometimes lead to unfair results for defendants struggling with mental illness. This case really makes you think, doesn't it?
It really does. This whole conversation has been eye-opening when it comes to mental illness and the law. What are some of the biggest takeaways for listeners, especially those working in law?
I think the most important thing for lawyers to remember from People v. Elmore is timing and strategy.
Okay.
The decision really emphasizes how important it is for defense attorneys to think carefully about when and how they bring up mental illness as part of the defense. Choosing the right strategy right from the start can be crucial.
So you're saying it's not as simple as just saying, hey, my client has a mental illness, so they're not responsible.
Definitely not. The Elmore case shows us that you can't use delusional beliefs to try to get a lesser charge during the guilt phase. If a defense attorney wants to use mental illness to argue that their client didn't have the intent for murder and try to get it reduced to manslaughter, they'll have to go the insanity route.
Which means focusing on that I'm not in standard during the sanity phase.
Exactly. This case shows why it's so important to understand the nuances of the different legal defenses and to pick the strategy that best fits the situation.
It sounds like defense attorneys need to be experts in both criminal law and mental health law to really handle these cases well.
Absolutely. It's not just about knowing the law. It's about understanding mental illness, how it presents, and how to present that information to the court in a way that's both persuasive and legally solid.
What's the bottom line here? What do you hope people take away from this case?
I think the biggest takeaway is that we need a more nuanced, more compassionate way of dealing with mental illness in the criminal justice system. The Elmore case shows the limitations of what we have now and challenges us to find better ways to balance accountability with understanding and support for people who are struggling with their mental health. It reminds us that the law doesn't always match up perfectly with human experience, especially when it comes to mental illness.
It's bigger than just the legal system, though, isn't it?
For sure. It's a societal issue. How do we ensure justice for victims, but also acknowledge the complexities of mental illness and how it can affect someone's actions? There aren't easy answers, but Elmore makes us confront these tough questions.
This has been a really fascinating deep dive. Lots of twists and turns, ethical considerations, and things that make you think. It feels like we've just scratched the surface.
We've covered a lot of ground, but this conversation needs to continue. People v. Elmore is a landmark case with wide-reaching implications. It's a case that people will be talking about and analyzing for years to come. Hopefully it leads to some positive changes in how we as a society view mental illness, both in the legal system and outside of it.
As we wrap up this deep dive, what's one question you'd like listeners to ponder?
Here's something to think about. If someone truly believes they're acting in self-defense, even if that belief comes from a delusion, should they be judged by the same legal standard as someone who acts with clear intent and understanding? It gets to the heart of criminal responsibility, mental health, and what justice really means.
That's a powerful question and one that I'll definitely be thinking about.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us today for this deep dive. It's been a truly insightful conversation.
It's been my pleasure. And to all our listeners, keep those minds engaged and keep asking those tough questions. Until next time, happy deep diving.